My special guest in the studio tonight was originally from Melbourne. She's been based in New York City since 1988 as a singer and composer. She's worked with many major jazz artists in the US and internationally, including recording with saxophonist Gary Bartz, the late pianist John Hicks, and the guitarist Paul Bollenbach. She's an accomplished composer, runs her own record label, Elephant Dreams, and has released five albums in New York City to critical acclaim. Chris McNulty, welcome to Now's the Time.
Thanks for having me in all this rain.
Chris, can we start by discussing how you came to jazz? Because there wasn't a lot of jazz music in your household, was there? Initially, your creative output was via a pen and a paper, wasn't it? Writing some
Yeah, you
poetry.
did some research, didn't
Yeah.
you? I'm sure it came by me the way it came by a lot of people back then. You were out there playing and somebody was playing something and it gets some people.
Yes,
And once you've got it, once you go in that direction, I think it's a hard corner to turn back around. So it was pretty early on, but it wasn't in my household as far as the kind of jazz that I've come to, explore as a vocalist composer, but it was certainly a lot of Tony Bennett and Frank Sinatra. So,
yeah,
I
so
mean, you
it's
can't really not call that jazz either in a way to me.
no, I mean,
Yeah.
It all stems from the Great American
Well,
Songbook
it's
in a way,
beautiful
doesn't it?
songs, beautiful singing, great arrangements, and great musicians playing it. So,
And of course, the lady we just heard, one of your influences, Sarah Vaughan,
oh yeah, Sarah was
one of my favorite
huge.
singers as well.
Yeah, how could she not be?
Well, what do you take from a talent like that, such as Sarah? How do you adopt whatever you take from her into your own style?
I don't think I was taking her into my whole psyche and being, knowing what style I was at the time, but I think I knew well enough because I'd had a good tense, I had a good solid innings there, getting my ear in and voice and tone and pitch and feel and chops in before I really got to the serious jazz thing. So I think what I heard from Sarah was that I was not going to try to sound like her,
No.
but I was absolutely going to strive to. I just wanted to like use her approach, and how she came at it was just so great. And I mean, I listened to all the great jazz divas of that period, and but there were very specific recordings that really impressed me and really influenced me more. So the live trio recordings of Sarah's were the tunes that I was, that I started singing.
Now, there are a lot of singers out there these days that call themselves jazz singers and really are just singing songs from the Great American Songbook. What are the key characteristics that differentiates a jazz singer from someone who's just simply doing that?
Well, it's hard for me to kind of grasp exactly who that might be. I mean, in New York, I mean, there's just a clear distinction between a jazz singer and a cabaret singer. And I think for everybody that's listening to music that has an appreciation for real jazz singing knows the difference. So I don't know whether I can make it any clearer than that, because it's, and I mean, most people know the difference as soon as they hear it. So I think it has to do with how you bring your musicians together and your arrangements. And there's some fantastic, Betty Buckley is an incredibly brilliant performer, and I wouldn't put her in a category of a jazz singer. She's singing some songs from the Great American Songbook, and she has wonderful musicians. I mean, she had Kenny Werner with her for donkey's years. I mean, so, but I would never hear that music as jazz. I would
No.
hear it as, well, you have to see it perform. So it's real performance stuff. And I'd only heard it for the first time a little while ago, and I was completely blown away by what she did.
Wow.
So, and I'm not somebody who's a fan of cabaret music, but if somebody does something that's really great, it deserves the same respect as any as.
Oh, of
So
course.
I don't know what I'm saying really, except that I don't really hear many singers. I don't hear many singers that are not real jazz singers, where I walk around the planet. So I'm in Russia or Ireland or the UK or Australia or whatever, and somebody's introducing me to somebody for the first time, or singers are coming to me to get lessons, and they're either really wanting to emulate the jazz thing, or they're singer songwriters, and they're but they're coming with some depth And they're coming with some real harmonic depth in their composing too. So, I mean, that to me is it really marks also the music of jazz, is that there's a lot of exploration harmonically and rhythmically, and you can do that with a standard, or you can do it with an original piece, and you can do it with a pop tune, revamp the whole thing and have it sound very much like a piece of serious jazz.
That's right. Mm. There's a lot of talk in the media at the moment, and even in the social media, about Paul McCartney's latest album, and it seems to be pitched in the sense that it's actually a jazz album, because Diana Krall's backing band just happens to be the band on the album. And it's quite interesting how something can be marketed as such when it really couldn't be any further from the truth.
Oh, well, marketing, if it's selling as that, I guess they're doing a good job. I don't know whether it's good for jazz or it's good for Paul McCartney. Maybe he knows what he's doing. He's a smart cookie, you know.
Having lived in New York City for 2 decades now, how has the jazz scene changed in America? Or in New York City?
I think the music business in general has just gone through massive, you know, reconstruction over the last 15 years. And I think jazz has been a casualty, and also it's also, you know, there's positives always out of the negatives. So out of being a casualty and out of the massive changes that have happened, some people have absorbed those changes and being able to keep up with it, and other people have just fallen by the wayside. You know, you have to be resilient in any field in the arts to survive a couple of decades. I mean, I've been in New York 24 years, so more than 2 decades, and I had a good innings here. So that I'm still doing it is sometimes I wonder how I had the stamina, because I raised a child on my own, and not just here, but there in a foreign country, in a place like New York, a very tough environment to do that and make sure that you maintain a quality of life for your child and for you. So I've seen people, really hang in there, hang tough, which you have to do in New York anyway. It's the United States is artists don't get the help that Australian artists get in any field. So it's a very tough place. I don't know. How has it changed? Well, we all know about, you know, the value of recorded music is, well, there's all kinds of stories that I could, you know, just examples of stories, like, you know, a check from CSAC for having a song on a well-known jazz musician's recording. I'm just going to leave all the names out of this, you know. But, you know, you might have gotten a check for $6,000 or $8,000, you know. And I'm sorry to say, it's shocking to say it, but, you know, it could be $8.75 now. They're not imagined stories or made up. They're stories very close proximity to musicians and artists that I know. And
that's pretty confronting, trying to earn a living in one of the most expensive cities on earth. Let's get positive.
Yeah.
What particular special musical moments come to mind when you think of the last 24 years in New York City?
For me? Well, there's many. I couldn't name one, but, I mean, 24 years, I don't know. I mean, memorable moments. Oh, God. You put me on the spot here. I mean, I guess memorable moments are always playing with incredibly brilliant, you know, people that you dreamed of. But that happened in Australia too. I mean, it's always the way, you know, you dream the dream and then you find yourself, you know, living the dream, and you can't believe it. You have to pinch yourself and say, "I'm really here."
Well, in my intro, I mentioned that you'd recorded with Gary Bartz. That must have been something quite significant.
I recorded with him a few times, actually. He's on A Time for Love. We have a beautiful version of I Loves You Porgy on that, with John Hicks played on that too. It's quite special. And then Dan Silicioso a few records later. He's on as well, and we've played together. I mean, we've done gigs together, and we've done a couple of festival dates, and so it's always great to have somebody like that. I think he's more, you know, following a hip hop theme right now.
Is he?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, you got to go where you can get work sometimes, and
yeah, I guess.
And if it's great, as I said, I mean, my son was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant musician and great hip hop artist, but you always hear jazz in his music. So we didn't talk about that, but my son tragically passed away 6 months ago, which is why I'm here, really. I'm here to celebrate his life and music and manage the release, posthumous release of his three projects, which I've been spending four or five months to create the vinyls and the CDs, and they've all arrived. So that's what I'm doing here.
Okay. Mm. So your son, what was his name?
Sam McNulty, Chap One, a.k.a. Chap One. Brilliant, brilliant artist and brilliant musician and just extraordinary human being.
Was he based here in Australia?
He was in Melbourne, yeah. Okay. Yep.
Chris, New York City's very much still a draw for jazz talent. Recently, we've seen a number of Australian artists head to Manhattan to base themselves there, live the dream. Do you ever ponder how your career might have turned out had you chosen to remain in Melbourne?
Well, you know, I didn't go from Melbourne to New York. I went from Sydney to New York. So I was in Sydney for 8 years before I went to New York. So I don't know. I think I got my real, made my mark here as a jazz singer in Sydney, not in Melbourne. So I was out on the road a lot and was just back there to do studio work, and I went out on the road. So really my real jazz career started in Sydney in a way, I think. It's where I was recognised and where people started to really give me a lot of kudos. I've thought a lot about the repercussions of staying in New York, mm-hmm. because I wasn't ever, my plan was not to. I was planning on staying just 3 months. I had no desire to be a single parent in a foreign country, let alone New York City. But, you know, that carrot got dangled, a record deal, so I stayed. And I've told this story a lot over the years. You know, you're halfway between either digging a hole or building a mountain. So there wasn't any one time where it felt like the right time to come back. And I saw a lot of people come back here with their tail between their legs. I mean, you really need to be comfortable being a little fish in a big ocean. And you have to be a certain kind of person to handle that, especially if you've had that notoriety and things have been easier for you. But in a way, I never found that easy in Australia either. So no. Not back then. No, it wasn't. It wasn't easy to be a jazz vocalist and aspire to want to just... I think the jazz scene here is really healthy. I have fantastic experiences here with great musicians, and Australian jazz scene is healthy, and Australian, the scene and the whole other side of the business should be very proud of their artists, because I'm telling you, there's some wonderful, wonderful musicians here and in New York. I mean, I play with Sam Anning, and Steve Newcomb is a great orchestrator, and I mean, that's just a couple of, you know, recent... There's a whole scene of great Australian musicians in New York, and it's a big, big group. And when I went there, there was no Australian musicians. There was like me and somebody else. So there wasn't any of that beautiful support between jazz musicians, Australian jazz musicians, that there is in New York now. So it really exists as a place that you can go to and not feel like you're missing home and you're missing these wonderful things that, you know, that I've missed every day of my life, really, since I left. But it's not difficult to be there now because there's so many Australian musicians and there's so many great ones here. I mean, I just played with Paul Grabowski, Frank Desario, Mike Jordan in Melbourne, and I'm playing with three great ones on Saturday.
Yeah, you've got Cameron Undy, the bass, beautiful Andrew player. Dickerson, the drums,
fantastic.
And Steve Barry on the piano.
Beautiful, beautiful piano player. The three of them, Cameron is fantastic. The great, great guys, great musicians.
Tell me, Chris, what was the word on the street in New York City last year when Nicholas Payton came out with that diatribe of his on why jazz isn't cool anymore? Did that create a lot of discussion within the ranks of the jazz community in New York? Jazz is dead?
I didn't really notice. I mean, I saw the post, but I mean, you know, people post whatever they want there, and
it seemed to get a fair amount of headlines, especially on the major websites like All About Jazz and
Did it?
E-Jazz. And
I don't know. Maybe there was other things going on for me. I saw it. I read some of it. But, you know, I read a lot of things that I could post a comment on, and just, you know, self-editing, just decided I wasn't going to go there. And I don't really remember the real content of that post, but I think people have opinions, and if they have the time to sit there and, you know, haggle it out and pass an opinion, well, good. That's a free country. Should be able to say what you want to say. And but I didn't really get into it. I think it probably went into a long-winded thing that I dismissed. But I do remember it.
the type of feel you're trying to create from releasing this album later on in the year.
It's called The Song That Sings You Here. Really, this record is as I said, I've moved on. I'm about to do a big orchestration recording with Steve Newcomb is going to be writing a lot of the orchestrations for it, and it's going to have a lot more original music. And this one was much more standard, so much more straight ahead, and I won't do that again for quite a long time. So, I mean, unless somebody just says, comes up with some really great idea why I should, I probably won't. But the thing that was important for me to document on this particular recording, and it is, as I said, this was done a while ago now, but that whole fiscal crisis in the States kind of put everybody on hold for a second, so it's a little late coming out because of that. It's really about what I do live around the world. I wanted to have the musicians on a recording that I play with around the globe, and so there's, two great Russian players, Andrei Kondakov on piano, beautiful player, great composer, Igor Butman on tenor and soprano, great player, he's like amazing. In Russia as well, he's got a great big band and does a lot of work with Wynton Marsalis. And
oh yeah,
yep. And there's the core rhythm section that's the American New York Cats, Paul Bollenbach, Ugano Kegwo, and Marcus Gilmore, great young drummer. I picked him up just before he got very busy. And then there's Graham Wood on piano, Australian connection. He mm-hmm. puts fantastic bands together. In Perth for me at the Ellington, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful human being, a great player, and Anita Wardell also has a little guest hang with me on The Lamp Is Low, which is also great. I wanted to have a couple of Aussies in there, and so she came out to the house in Pennsylvania, and we did a track with her.
Well, we're looking forward to getting the final product. That's coming out around about
August. August on Challenge Records, yeah.
So we're looking forward to that. Chris, thanks very much for joining us in the studio tonight.
Thank you for having me.